Kuhn Review, Print Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the National Podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @KuhnReview, that is @CUEANDREVIEW. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@kuhnreview.com. That is information@CUEANDREVIEW.com. Or by calling 0141 772 3976. That's 0141 772 3976.
This is from The National on Friday, the 8th of March, 2024, from the news section. Emma Caldwell. Public inquiry to be held into investigation of murder. This article is written by Laura Pollock. A public inquiry is to be held into the police investigation of the murder of Emma Caldwell, almost 2 decades ago, Scottish Justice Secretary Angela Constance has announced. The announcement comes after both Scottish First Minister Humza Yousaf and his Justice Secretary Angela Constance met with a murdered woman's mother earlier this week, and Miss Caldwell's family was told that evidence existed to prosecute her murderer Ian Packer in 2008. Packer, 51, was sentenced to life with a minimum term of 36 years at the High Court in Glasgow last week, after being found guilty of murdering the 27-year-old in 2005, as well as 11 rapes and 21 other charges, including sexual assaults against other women. Miss Caldwell's mother, Margaret, met Lord Advocate Dorothy Bain, KC, at the Crown Office in Edinburgh on Thursday, ahead of the ministerial statement on a public inquiry into the botched investigation of her daughter's murderer. In Holyrood, the Justice Secretary laid out her next steps, who she would engage in contact, and said she was open to an inquiry chair from Outwith Scotland. Constance said, "Margaret Caldwell and her family have waited far too long to get justice for Emma. I have expressed directly to them on behalf of the Scottish Government how deeply sorry we are for their loss and for the pain and grief they have had to endure. 19 years have elapsed between Emma's murder and a conviction, showing serious failings occurred in the investigation. Given this, along with the gravity of this case, the length of time it took for the justice to be served, for so many women and the horrific extent of the sexual violence suffered by the victims and survivors, the case for holding a public inquiry is overwhelming. The family want to have answers and deserve nothing less. The First Minister made clear that we would give serious consideration to the Caldwell family's call for a public inquiry after hearing directly from Margaret Caldwell and her family, and pledged we would do so quickly. I am glad that now we have been able to answer their call by announcing that we will set up a public inquiry." The Secretary also told MSPs what Emma Caldwell's mother, Margaret, said to her. She said, "Mrs. Caldwell told her, 'My daughter Emma and many victims who so courageously spoke up deserve nothing less than a robust, independent public inquiry and a judge who will act without fear or favour. There are those who say that such inquiries take too long. My family have struggled for 19 years to get justice, and we will wait however long it takes to see the truth, and will accept nothing less." Scottish Conservative Justice spokesman Russell Findlay praised the Caldwell family, and Margaret in particular, saying, "Their strength and their dignity are truly humbling." He told MSPs, "Their campaign for Emma has been backed by good police officers, lawyers and journalists. But let me be clear, the only reason that her daughter's killer is now behind bars is because of her love and her strength. Left to Police Scotland and the Crown Office, I believe that Ian Packer would certainly still be out there, raping women with impunity. Findlay pushed the Justice Secretary on whether the judge appointed to lead the inquiry will come from outside Scotland, with Constance saying she is open to the suggestion. Scottish Labour Justice spokeswoman Pauline McNeill said, "It is the job of the Parliament to ensure no family should ever have to wait 2 decades for justice. Scottish Labour stands full square behind the government and Angela Constance today in her decision to hold a public inquiry to establish why, among other things, there was no prosecution in 2008 when it appeared the police and the Crown had enough evidence to do so. A public inquiry must get to the truth of this, and that includes questioning all of the criminal justice agencies who have questions to answer." McNeill went on to back a judge from outside of Scotland being appointed to head the inquiry and urged Constance to ensure the probe begins in a timely manner. That article was written by Laura Pollock. This is from The National on Friday the 8th of March 2024 from the news section. Ministry of Defence spends £500,000 on officers to open doors for the King. This article is written by Hamish Morrison. The UK military spent more than £500,000 on officers to open doors for the royals, it has emerged. The Ministry of Defence, MOD, has admitted spending £506,681.18 on equerries, officers whose job it is to serve the King and other senior royals. This money is covered by the MOD, not the royal household, according to the military's response to a Freedom of Information request from the campaign group Republic. It is not clear how many equerries are employed to work for the royal family, though there were 3 present at the Queen's funeral in September, according to the BBC. 2 were in the presence of Princess Beatrice and Princess Eugenie, while another rode in procession with Prince William and Catherine, Princess of Wales. 3 people have been named as working as equerries for King Charles and Queen Camilla in media reports: Lieutenant Commander Will Thornton of the Fleet Air Arm, Major Ollie Plunkett, and the senior equerry Lieutenant Colonel Johnny Thompson. Republic CEO Graham Smith said the MOD spending money to use highly trained military personnel as window dressing for the King was disgraceful. He added, "I am calling on the military and government to stop this practice immediately. We are often hearing that the military is stretched and understaffed. With its additional commitments to Ukraine, how can the government justify spending any of the country's defence budgets on people to open doors for Charles, Camilla and William? Charles dodged a massive inheritance tax bill 18 months ago. The royals are worth more than £1 billion. Why can't they employ their own equerries?" In its response to Republic, the MOD said that the costs of employing equerries was covered by fixed staff costs, meaning the money would still be incurred by the MOD regardless of where these personnel were employed. But Smith said, "The MOD has said this is not additional spending, but it is the use of officers that could be used elsewhere, doing the job they were trained to do." The MOD was approached for comment. That article was written by Hamish Morrison. This is from The National on Friday the 8th of March 2024 from the news section. NATO. Sweden officially becomes 32nd member. This article is written by James Walker. Sweden has formally joined NATO as the 32nd member of the Transatlantic Military Alliance, ending decades of post-Second World War neutrality, as concerns about Russian aggression have spiked after the invasion of Ukraine. Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson and Secretary of State Antony Blinken presided at a ceremony in which Sweden's instrument of accession to the alliance was officially deposited at the State Department. This is a historic moment for Sweden. It's historic for alliance. It's history for the transatlantic relationship, Blinken said. Our NATO alliance is now stronger, larger than it's ever been. Later on Thursday, Kristersson will visit the White House and then be a guest of honour at President Joe Biden's State of the Union address to Congress. The White House said that having Sweden as a NATO ally will make the United States and our allies even safer. NATO is the most powerful defensive alliance in the history of the world, and it is as critical today to ensuring the security of our citizens as it was 75 years ago, when our alliance was founded out of the wreckage of World War II, a spokesperson said. Sweden, along with Finland, which joined NATO last year, both abandoned long-standing military neutrality that was a hallmark of the Nordic states' Cold War foreign policy after Russia invaded Ukraine in early 2022. Biden, in his speech to Congress, is expected to cite Sweden's accession to NATO as evidence that Russian President Vladimir Putin's intent to divide and weaken the alliance has failed as a direct result of the Ukraine invasion. And the president is expected to use Sweden's decision to join to step up calls for reluctant Republicans to approve stalled military assistance to Ukraine as the war enters its third year. Sweden's membership had been held up due to objections by NATO members Turkey and Hungary. Turkey expressed concern that Sweden was harbouring and not taking enough action against Kurdish groups that it regards as terrorist, and Hungary's populist President Viktor Orban has shown pro-Russian sentiment and not shared the alliance's determination to support Ukraine. After months of delay, Turkey ratified Sweden's admission earlier this year, and Hungary did so last week. That article was written by James Walker. This is from The National on Friday, the 8th of March, 2024. From the culture section. Scottish gin featured in Oscar's gift bag, set for limited release. This article is written by Ross Hunter. The limited edition Scottish gin, set to be included in this year's luxury Oscar's gift bag, is set to go on sale to the public. Award-winning gin company Gin Bothy said their limited edition batch gin, which has been given to all nominees as part of the Everybody Wins Oscars gift bag, worth around $125,000, will also be made available for purchase. Distilled by the Angus-based producer specifically for nominees such as Martin Scorsese, Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling, the batch was made using Scottish heather, Scots pine and rosemary. Originally numbered between 1 to 25 for each of the nominees, Gin Bothy founder Kim Cameron decided to release the remainder of the 300-bottle batch to the general public. "This is not just a celebration for Hollywood," she said. "It's an invitation for everyone to experience the glamour and taste of the Oscars. Rather than hold on to the remainder of this unique batch, we decided to make them available for anyone to buy. The Oscars are one of the biggest events in the world, and so being able to bring a piece of that to our customers is really exciting." Cameron, who said she stumbled into gin making accidentally after discovering her talent for it while making jam in her kitchen, said the bottles will even come with a commemorative figurine. "While most of us can only dream of winning an Oscar," she added, "anyone who gets their hands on one of the 300 bottles will certainly be able to practice their winner's speeches with ease, as each bottle comes with a miniature 6-inch Oscar figure to commemorate the event. It isn't the first time Scotland has been associated with the Oscars gift bags. In 2022, many criticised the inclusion of a plot of Scottish land in the gift bags. The company, Highland Titles, claimed that the plot of land entitled recipients to refer to themselves as Laird or Lady of Glencoe. However, this claim was disputed by legal experts such as Andy Whiteman. That article was written by Ross Hunter. This is from The National on Friday, the 8th of March, 2024, from the news section. Scottish police will no longer investigate every crime, Force says. This article is written by Xander Eliards. Police Scotland will no longer investigate every crime after the success of a pilot in the North East. The pilot scheme, announced in September 2023, saw officers no longer take action on some minor crimes in order to focus more on emergency response and public safety. On Thursday, an evaluation of the Proportionate Response to Crime scheme was published, recommending that the methodology be rolled out across all of Scotland. Police said that during the 12-week trial, 5% of crimes reported in A Division, Aberdeen, Aberdeenshire and Moray, were filed for no further inquiry, freeing up 2,657 police officer hours. Examples of crimes that were listed for no further inquiry included 1. A caller whose car's bumper was damaged in a car park with no CCTV present or note left. 2. A caller who returned home after 4 weeks away to find two garden ornaments missing, with no CCTV or witnesses. 3. A caller who had delivery of a parcel confirmed, only for it to be missing when they returned home, with no CCTV or witnesses. 4. A caller who left their bag unattended in a park and realised their phone was missing when they got home. The decision not to take action on a particular crime came after an assessment of threat, harm, risk, vulnerability and for proportionate lines of investigation and evidence, police said. Police said that people who report crimes will now be told that there is no hope of an investigation more quickly than they previously would have been. The Force also reported that since the introduction of the process in the North East, public satisfaction rates have improved, while more people who contact the police also say they got an appropriate response. Prior to the pilot, 72% of A Division officers reported that they would regularly be allocated crime reports when no proportionate lines of inquiry existed. At the conclusion of the pilot, 68% of them said they had noticed a positive difference to their workload, and 56% felt they had more time to investigate crime reports which had been proportionate lines of inquiry. Assistant Chief Constable Emma Bond said, "The proportionate response to crime process is not a policy of non-investigation. We are committed to investigating crime. Taking a proportionate response to crime is not a new concept, but we've never had a national process or standard across Scotland. Our evaluation recommends this process is rolled out across the rest of the service, and we intend to do this on a phased basis with ongoing engagement and evaluation. Every crime report is subject of individual assessment of threat, harm, risk, vulnerability, and for proportionate lines of investigation and evidence, and that won't change. If there are no lines of inquiry that can be pursued, then we should be clear about that with the person who has contacted us. The public will be informed about the progress of their report more quickly, rather than waiting for days for officers to make contact to inform them of the same outcome. By taking a proportionate response to crime reporting, we can give officers more time to focus on local policing, keeping people safe from harm, protecting the vulnerable, bringing criminals to justice, solving problems, and reducing offending. Please continue to report crime to us. All reports are recorded, and even if they are closed, are passed to our local policing teams to be kept under review, and to help build an intelligence picture, enabling them to proactively respond to local concerns. We have listened carefully to feedback about the process during the pilot period, and we're using this important information to further shape the process and engage with partner organisations. That article was written by Zander Eliards.
This is from The National on Monday, 11th March 2024, from the Politics section. Douglas Ross told to whip Scottish Tories against windfall tax, by Hamish Morrison. Douglas Ross has been warned he will be Scottish Tory leader in name only if he does not whip his MPs to vote against the windfall tax extension. SNP MP Kirsty Blackman said the Murray MP faces being humiliated if he is the only Scottish Tory at Westminster to vote against the plans set out in Chancellor Jeremy Hunt's budget. Hunt announced earlier this month that the levy on oil and gas profits will be extended by a further 12 months to 2029. Ross condemned the decision and said he will not vote for it when it comes before the House of Commons. UK Energy Minister Andrew Bowie, also the MP for West Aberdeenshire and Kincardine, also said he was deeply disappointed in the plans, but has since clarified he will support the measure. The SNP are against the Tories' windfall tax, saying the money raised is being spent in the wrong place, and criticise Labour's oil and gas tax plans on the same grounds. Blackman, an Aberdeen North MP, said Ross should force his spineless colleagues to join him in rejecting the extension. The SNP politician said Douglas Ross must whip his spineless seven Tory MPs to vote against these damaging plans, which threaten to destroy jobs and investment across Scotland. Mr. Ross has already been humiliated by the Tory Chancellor, who shafted Scotland with this policy. Now it looks like he'll be humiliated again by his own MPs, making him leader in name only and raising questions over how much longer he can stay in his role with no influence. Voters in Scotland are getting ready to kick the Tories out at the next election, and by voting SNP we can make Scotland Tory free. Unlike Sunak and Starmer, the SNP will always stand up for Scotland's interests, defend Scottish jobs, and demand the best deal for Scottish families. Ross's position as leader of the Scottish Conservatives has no procedural importance in the House of Commons, and all Tory MPs are accountable to the Chief Whip. Scottish Conservative energy spokesperson Douglas Lumsden said, Kirsty Blackman and the SNP are displaying breathtaking hypocrisy, masquerading as a friend of Scotland's oil and gas industry when their own policy is to end North Sea production, which would decimate the sector and the 100,000 jobs it supports across Scotland. They have a nerve to try and play political games with the industry when Kirsty has herself stated that she is against granting new oil and gas licences, showing a blatant disregard for the livelihoods of her Aberdeen constituents. The SNP were also the first party to call for a windfall tax, and it's only a few months since Humza Yousaf was proclaiming the end of the industry in a speech in New York. Not only that, but the SNP government have refused to include any carbon capture, utilisation and storage funding in their Scottish budget and want nothing more than to create grievance and uncertainty over projects like Acorn near Peterhead. Their ridiculous take is absolutely absurd and is an insult to people's intelligence. That article was by Hamish Morrison. This is from The National on Monday, 11th March 2024, from the News section. This is rigged. Redistribute stolen baby formula in Glasgow city centre. By Adam Robertson. Campaigners with This Is Rigged have set up a stall of stolen baby formula on Buchanan Street in Glasgow. It comes as the group demands supermarkets slash the prices of baby formula to March 2021 prices and that the Scottish Government implement a community food hub per every 500 households in Scotland. The latest action follows a series of protests in February, including when protesters targeted the UK government offices in Edinburgh. The group are set up in Glasgow city centre with a sign that reads, "We stole this baby formula. Happy Mother's Day from This Is Rigged." Protesters say they want to draw the attention of the stark increases in the prices of essential goods, specifically baby products such as formula. In a statement released on social media, the group explained their actions by saying, "We are asking for the bare minimum, our inalienable human right to baseline food security, but we're also asking for dignity. No longer will we beg for scraps from the tables of greedy CEOs. No longer will we be at the mercy of corporations who price us out of eating on a whim, dependent on them to provide us with our foundational needs. No longer will we tolerate a criminally incompetent government that refuses to address the crisis in food security in this country." One of the group's members, 25-year-old intensive care nurse Rona, said she was taking action because she sees directly how people are impacted by food security. "As a nurse, I see the effects of our government's austerity measures on a daily basis. For supermarkets to be pushing their prices up while people are struggling to afford to eat is a disgrace," she said. Retired teacher Kate, 69, said, "I think it is important to show how appalled I am about what the government is not doing to combat this crisis. We want to spread awareness of this issue and highlight how the food redistribution that we are doing should not be necessary. And based on conversations today, the people of Glasgow agree." That article was by Adam Robertson.
From The National, Monday the 11th of March, from the comment section, "Gove's plan to tackle extremism will take us into sinister territory," by columnist George Keravan. Governments at the fag end of their allotted time and awaiting electoral oblivion have a habit of going bonkers. This usually involves being fixated with irrelevant policy proposals that are of more interest to their soon-to-disappear MPs than anyone in the real world. Thus, Rishi Sunak is obsessed with spending multiple millions on sending a few dozen asylum seekers on an extended stay in Rwanda. Now Michael Gove, whose cabinet job, remember, is about levelling up, had become obsessed with changing the law to ban political opinions that the government deems unacceptable. Gove is normally one of the more sensible Tory ministers, though admittedly that's a low bar. This week he is set to announce a controversial plan to ban from public life individuals and groups who undermine the UK's system of liberal democracy. This is sneaky and at the thin end of a very long wedge. Gove is not proposing outright legal bans on organisations or the jailing of individuals, yet. That would necessitate complex legislation and inevitable court challenges. Think Rwanda. Instead, organisations and individuals that breach Gove's new official definition of extremism will be excluded from meetings or engagement with ministers, civil servants, local authorities and, crucially, from state funding. This is a demonisation by administrative fiat, but it is the road to authoritarianism. According to the Observer newspaper, which has seen leaked copies of Gove's plans. The government intends to define a list of core behaviours which it deems to constitute extremism. Not illegal actions as such, but attitudes. These will include attempts to overturn, exploit or undermine the UK's system of liberal democracy, which seek to confer advantages or disadvantages on specific groups, and which enable the spread of extremism. Talk about loose drafting. As a long-time supporter of Scottish independence, I certainly want to overturn the UK's system of liberal democracy, largely because it isn't liberal, and it certainly isn't democratic. In fact, I've spent decades marching, demonstrating, writing and fighting against a system I consider domineering, exploitative and anti-democratic. I've even called for civil disobedience to end the union, all of which makes me a prime contender to be sectioned under the new rules, and the rest of the national movements in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. That bit about conferring advantages or disadvantages on specific groups is an especially dangerous catch-all. I want to confer an advantage on the people of Scotland. I want them to govern themselves rather than being in a colonial relationship with Whitehall. Also, I want to be able to meet with ministers, MPs, civil servants and quangle bosses to lobby for Scottish rights and needs. I don't want Gove banning such meetings on a political whim. If there is anybody trying to undermine the liberal bit of democracy, it is Gove. Wait, I hear from the back of the room. These new rules are about curbing the influence of extremist organisations that knowingly take advantage of democracy, including the right to protest, in order to foment chaos. That make life a misery for ordinary folk by creating a climate of fear. The trouble is that one Tory minister's definition of extremist is not the same as mine or yours. And if democracy is about anything, it's about the right to dissent. Gove's rules blur the distinction between legitimate dissent and deliberate subversion, and he knows it. The Tory government is exhibiting all signs of a moral panic. Recently, the Prime Minister told a gathering of senior police officers that the UK is descending into mob rule. Cue a green light for the police to deal more harshly with demonstrators. Sunak also demanded a crackdown on protests outside Parliament, political parties' offices and town halls that cause alarm, harassment or distress. Might it be that demonstrating is all about causing a little alarm in ruling circles? The tone of Sunak's remarks to the police chiefs is very worrying. He said, "There is a growing consensus that mob rule is replacing democratic rule, and we've got to collectively, all of us, change that urgently. Now, whatever side you take on issues of the day, by any historical standard, recent protests in the UK have been fairly restrained. At the start of the 20th century, at least 4 people were killed in violence deliberately instigated by supporters of direct action to gain female suffrage. Phosphorus letter bombs were sent to the Prime Minister and leading politicians, burning postal workers. Railway signal wires were cut, disrupting rail commuting wholesale. Suffragette leader Emmeline Pankhurst was arrested for planning an attack on Lloyd George's house. We are nowhere near this level of mob violence." In the 1930s, black shirt fascist thugs clashed in British streets with the left wing and Jewish protesters, with a level of violence greater than anything we have seen in the UK in recent years. In the Battle of Cable Street in October 1936, more than 100,000 anti-fascists fought the entire Metropolitan Police to a standstill, blocking a black shirt march to London's East End. There were repeated violent clashes in Scotland between fascists, often brought in from England, and protesters. In Edinburgh in 1934, anti-fascist demonstrators attacked a bus carrying black shirts, smashing the windows and blinding one fascist. The result of this unprecedented street violence was the infamous Public Order Act, used by the Thatcher government half a century later to crush the 1984-85 miners' strike. And, talking of the miners' strike, one can hardly compare the niggling provocations against the system of extension, rebellion, with Arthur Scargill's attempt to, in reality, bring down Margaret Thatcher. On June 18th, 1984, 8,000 miners assembled for a mass picket at the Ogreave coking plant in South Yorkshire. They were confronted by 4,500 police officers from different forces who were there to batter the miners into submission. Much later, the miners sued for assault, wrongful arrest and malicious prosecution. In 1991, South Yorkshire Police paid out £425,000 in damages. Sunak's exaggerated protestations and Gove's proposals for administrative bans are a sign this Tory government is beyond being bankrupt of ideas. Witness the vacuous, misleading budget last week. We are now in sinister territory. If history has any lessons, it is that loose, undemocratic legislation introduced during a moral panic normally ends up later being used to restrict legitimate democratic rights, which is why we must oppose Gove's latest brainwave. I'm suspicious about why his plans have been leaked. Most likely he did it himself. It is part of the mood music Tories are orchestrating as they head for electoral massacre. They are indulging in a strategy of tension in order to hold on to whatever votes they can in the Tory heartlands and beyond the Red Wall. But they are only feeding the populist beast. Imagine Gove's administrative bans in the hands of Nigel Farage or Suella Braverman. Democracy is a tender plant. Late capitalism has showered us with commodities, but only at the expense of eroding our humanity and making us perpetually anxious. To fill this emotional vacuum, the populist right is stirring up yet another moral panic. But remember, if they come for someone else today, they will come for you tomorrow. And that article was by George Keravan. From the National, Monday the 11th of March, from the comment section. We can't let those in power weaponise language against us. By Steph Peaton. Last year, when professionals suffered, Sarah Brady shared text messages she had allegedly received from her former boyfriend, actor Jonah Hill, the internet was abuzz with condemnation of the coercive nature of them. According to the published communications, Hill outlined his expectations of being in a relationship with Brady, including his need for her to stop suffering with men, as well as diktats on social media use and who she should and should not be spending time with. These, they said, were his boundaries, a therapy term relating to limits we set ourselves on how we are treated by others, not to dictate how others can live their lives. The preceding decades have certainly brought the benefits of therapy and the means by which we would discuss it more firmly into the mainstream. But with that increased spotlight, there has also been an increase in the weaponisation of professional language that has been used to justify behaviour antithetical to its aims. However, this problem extends far beyond therapy speak. The arena of social justice has also been co-opted by many whose goals are fundamentally rooted in maintaining their power over others. As with therapy, the language of social justice is mainstream now. A greater understanding of the lives of others has gifted us insight into the layers of intersecting oppressions that exist in our culture. But, as with therapy, this has been inverted by groups and activists who have realised that the misuse of terms like misogyny and anti-Semitism and racism can be a shield to them. In anticipation of an expected bad faith reading of this column, let me emphasise that these prejudices and biases are disgustingly real and present in contemporary Britain. But misuse, both from ignorance and by intent, has muddied the waters and left many uncertain how to talk about these issues without offending. In other cases, definitions have been stretched so far as to have been broken entirely, leaving headlines and politicians' speeches far more vague than the wording at first glance suggests. When I read about rising anti-Semitism in the news, I'm now left wondering, is it all for referencing Britain's burgeoning far-right extremism that's seen bigots march while chanting, "Jews will not replace us"? Or are we talking about peaceful marches against the genocide in Gaza? When I hear the term misogyny being used in British press, is it in relation to institutional discrimination against women? Or is it being cynically deployed to smear the transgender community for the crime of existing? When I see the right-wing press suddenly showing an interest in tackling racism, now I wonder if we are talking about racism at all, or just the attention-seeking whine of a failed white actor in blackface. These are all real systemic issues in society. But we are facing a dearth of political literacy when someone protesting the killing of 30,000 Palestinians, the starvation, the executions, the allegations of zip-tied civilians being deliberately crushed by tanks, can be glibly dismissed as being motivated by anti-Semitism. It requires the absolute worst faith interpretation of the motivations to oppose stopping something as horrific as the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. But what it does provide, for anyone depraved enough, is a conversation killer that can be cynically weaponized to skirt around accountability. It is, in many ways, a continuation of the exploitation of minority groups that we have come to expect, a useful deflection that uses our words to maintain the status quo rather than challenge it. The powerful have taken the language that we have built to discuss power structures and inverted it to reinforce them. It reminds me of a time a number of years ago when one columnist tweeted a garbled word salad of terms that, I believe, he thought was a comedic takedown of woke language. But what struck me as being so revealing about his mindset was that each of the phrases and words used had the legitimate meaning behind it, something that would have been clear to anyone who had engaged openly with discussions at the time around Britain's colonial history. To him, each turn of phrase was as confusing and meaningless as if a random word generator had spat it out, and in trying to take a swing at this language, he had only highlighted his ignorance on the issue. It seems such a poignant example of how the media class often speaks with total confidence on issues it doesn't even remotely understand, and how its ignorance has had a terrible cost. The inversion or dereliction of meaning is, I believe, the only explanation of why a supposedly grassroots feminist movement against trans people is dominated by misogynistic men, and why groups allegedly against anti-Semitism have the full support of far-right figures. A contradiction, no? Now, the UK government is seemingly preparing to expand its definition of extremism through the Prevent scheme to include anti-abortion activists, socialists and communists, buoyed by the framing of peace marches as anti-Semites and anti-fascists as violent insurrectionists. Challenging power requires understanding power. That's true whether we're talking about Jonah Hill or the British state. We can debate the nuances, yes, but what we could never do is let the language that we use to challenge power become the language used to protect it. And that was a comment piece by Steph Payton.
The National, recorded on Wednesday, 13th of March 2024. The Culture section. Back in the day, Sir James Hector, a Scottish geologist and explorer to boot, by Hamish McPherson, journalist. One of the world's leading geologists and an intrepid explorer to boot, Sir James Hector is one of the many Scots who is more revered in his adopted country than in his native land. The phrase explorer to boot is very apt because Hector was once involved in an incident that nearly cost him his life and ended with a mountain pass in the Canadian Rockies being given a name which commemorates that incident to this day. This week sees the 190th anniversary of Hector's birth. He was born in Edinburgh on March 16, 1834, the son of a lawyer, Alexander Hector, and his wife Margaret née McCrosty. Educated at Edinburgh Academy and Edinburgh University, Hector graduated in medicine at the age of 22. At university, he carried out studies in geology, and he came to the attention of Sir Roderick Murchison, director of the British Geological Survey. At the time of Hector's graduation, the British North American Exploring Expedition was being planned, and Murchison recommended Hector's services both as a geologist and doctor to the leader of the expedition, Captain James Palliser. The expedition was eventually named after Palliser, but it was really a cooperative effort by Palliser, Hector, the astronomer Thomas Blakiston, astronomer and secretary John W. Sullivan, and the French botanist Eugène Bourgeau, all of whom have geographical features of Canada named after them. The aim of the Palliser expedition was to explore the Canadian portion of the Rockies from 1857 to 1860, accompanied by his trusted guide Nimrod of the Stony Nakoda tribe of natives. Hector led the survey of the magnificent Bow Valley in Alberta, his work being commemorated in the name of Hector Lake in the valley. It was an adventure that nearly killed the Scot. We know exactly what happened on August 28, 1858, because they recorded it in the Palliser Expedition Diary. We met a very large stream, equal in size to Bow River where we crossed it. This river descended the valley from the northwest and on entering the wide valley of Beaverfoot River, turns back in its course at a sharp angle, receives that river as a tributary, and flows off to the southwest through the other valley. Just above the angle there is a fall about 40 feet 12 metres in height, where the channel is contracted by perpendicular rocks. A little way above this fall, one of her pack horses, to escape the fallen timber, plunged into the stream. Luckily, where it formed an eddy, but the banks were so steep that we had great difficulty in getting him out. In attempting to re-catch my own horse, which had strayed off while we were engaged with the one in the water, he kicked me in the chest, but I had luckily got close to him before he struck out, so I did not get the full force of the blow. However, it knocked me down and rendered me senseless for some time. The kick to his chest had knocked Hector clean out, and his companions were soon convinced that he was dead, as he appeared not to be breathing, so they laid him down under the shade of a tree. His assistant, Peter Erasmus, checked him after an hour and could find no trace of a pulse or breathing. They decided to bury Hector at the scene, and were just about to lay him to rest when one of the men noticed one of his eyes blinking. They quickly managed to revive the young Scottish doctor, who was in great pain but alive, just. He and his party only survived after the Stony Nakoda people came to their rescue. His companions instantly named the area where the incident occurred as Kicking Horse Pass, and it has retained the name ever since. Undaunted, Hector began a new stage in the expedition, discovering mountains, passes, rivers and lakes that were unknown to all but the native tribes. For his role in the palace of the expedition, Hector was made a fellow of both the Royal Society of Edinburgh and the Royal Geographical Society. In 1862, he set off for New Zealand. His talents as a planner, organiser and leader of men had been very much in evidence in Canada, and now he was put in charge of the Geological Survey of Otago, which over the course of 3 years surveyed much of the South Island of New Zealand and charted such things as the mineral wealth and plant species of the area. Hector's innovative geology was recognised around the world, and recommendations for economic growth in the South Island were also followed. In 1865, he organised a section of that year's New Zealand exhibition in Dunedin, the city named for Edinburgh by Scottish immigrants to the country. He was now a well-known name in the country, and having already been recognised by the central government, he was put in charge of various federal undertakings such as the Colonial Museum in Wellington, though his collecting of Maori artefacts would bring him posthumous criticism. When the New Zealand Parliament established an Institute for the Advancement of Scientific Knowledge in 1867, there was only one man to head it up, and that was Hector. At one time or another, he was responsible for the management of the country's standards of weights and measures, the Patent Office Library, the Meteorological Department, the Colonial Observatory, and the Wellington Botanic Garden. In 1868, he married Maria Georgiana, the daughter of the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Sir David Munro. They would have 6 children in all. Hector was in constant demand for advice on a whole range of issues. He wrote 45 scientific papers in all, as well as publishing his own guides to the natural wonders of New Zealand. He was honoured by several countries and was knighted by Queen Victoria in 1887, while serving 18 years as the Chancellor of New Zealand University. He lived for many years in Lower Hutt near Wellington, and died there on November 6, 1907, aged 73. The Royal Society of New Zealand's top award for research is named the Hector Medal after him. By Hamish McPherson.
The National News on Wednesday, the 13th of March. Holyrood fails to confirm financial support for Storm Gerrit flood victims. An article written by Daniel van Reenen. It's been 3 months since Storm Gerrit caused the waters of Ladyburn to rise and sweep through homes and businesses in Cooper, and yet there's been no help from the government. Following a debate at the Scottish Parliament on Tuesday, it continues to seem unlikely that financial aid will be provided any time soon. North East Fife Lib Dem MSP Willie Rennie has been fighting for funding on behalf of the people of Cooper since the storm flooded their homes just after Christmas. He raised the issue at Holyrood on Tuesday, asking the Scottish Government to back a comprehensive plan for the River Eden and to confirm grants for people whose homes and businesses were flooded. 7-year-old Amelia burst into tears at the bottom of the stairs in her house as the still unwrapped Christmas presents were swallowed up by the flood, Mr. Rennie began. Caroline watched her house flood, knowing that there was nothing she could do to protect it. She lost family pictures, personal effects, and her home. Soon-to-be-married Nina had a buyer for her house and was ready to move to a new chapter in her life. But within minutes, the Ladyburn in Cooper burst its banks and flooded their homes with muddy, stinking water. He continued, "Their distress has now turned to fury. fury at all the talk but no practical action. If talk could hold back the water, we would never have a flood in Cooper ever again. He asked Climate Secretary Mary McAllen to confirm that the government will provide a small grant scheme to the flood victims in Cooper, the same as they provided to flood victims from Storm Babet in Angus last autumn. "I'm very happy to work on the issue of the River Eden catchment plan," she told MSPs. On the more immediate point about support to households in the community, "I absolutely have sympathy for what was experienced. We have since reached out to Fife Council to have an idea of the impacted communities, and I remain open to providing funding." She continued, "If Willie Rennie wants to meet with me about that, he's very welcome, and I will continue to speak with Fife Council about impacted communities." Crucially, however, Mr. Rennie said Ms. McAllen failed to confirm grants for the people of Cooper, leaving them out of pocket for damages and repair. "The government has been stalling for months, and now the best the minister could offer was a meeting. Frankly, that is an insult to desperate flood victims in Cooper who are out of pocket. They don't want sympathy, they want a decision," Mr. Rennie said, speaking after the debate. "I've been told for months that grants were being seriously considered, but it shouldn't take so long to consider a small grant scheme. The government acted within weeks to provide support to people in Angus. They now seem to have been stringing people in Cooper along and taking them for fools." An article written by Daniel Van Reenen. The National News on Wednesday, the 13th of March. Jason Leach announces that he will step down as clinical director. An article written by Ross Hunter. Professor Jason Leach announced yesterday that he will be stepping down as national clinical director. Professor Leach became a household name in Scotland during the COVID-19 pandemic, appearing frequently on television and radio in order to explain the coronavirus rules and the progression of the virus. Professor Leach said that he would leave the post of National Clinical Director in April in order to look for new challenges across health and care after a break. The top scientific advisor said, "It's been an enormous privilege to carry out this role and work closely with colleagues across the health and care sector in service of the patients, their families and carers. The NHS and social care system does remarkable work every day, and I'm immensely proud of the teams I've had the privilege of being part of. The ongoing success of the Scottish Patient Safety Programme is globally recognised and has significantly improved the safety and reliability of care in so many ways. The COVID pandemic was an unprecedented challenge for all countries, and I'm proud of my colleagues inside and outside government for their incredible work. It was a privilege to be able to communicate with the public so directly and be part of that coordinated response, and I'll forever be grateful for the public's attention and willingness to follow the guidance. It did save lives. I've decided to look for new challenges across health and care after a break and to spend more time with the charities I work with. I wish colleagues well for the future." Professor Leach, who worked as an oral surgery consultant before gaining a role within the Scottish Government, has served as National Clinical Director since 2015. He will also leave his post at NHS Tayside when he steps down. First Minister Hamza Yousaf thanked Professor Leach for his work. He said, "Jason Leach has made a fantastic contribution to the health of the nation, leading work to reduce hospital-acquired infections and improve the quality of care in the NHS. The enduring success of the Scottish Patient Safety Programme is testament to his work. He played a huge role in helping me and fellow ministers navigate the COVID pandemic by providing advice to help reach the best decisions and by communicating so well with the public. I, of course, wish him every success in the future." Former First Minister Nicola Sturgeon also thanked Professor Leach for his public service. On X, formerly known as Twitter, she said, "Wishing Jason Leach all the very best for the future. I always valued the advice and support he gave me, first as Health Secretary and then as First Minister, not least during COVID when he was a key part of the Scottish Government team and a reassuring presence for many across the country." An article written by Ross Hunter. The National Politics on Wednesday, the 13th of March. Starmer will not be probed by the Commons. An article written by Steph Braun. Sir Keir Starmer will not be referred to the Commons Privileges Committee for investigation over the Gaza ceasefire debate, deputy speakers have said. SNP, Conservative and Plaid Cymru MPs had requested an investigation alleging the Labour leader pressured Lindsay Hoyle to select his party's amendment during an SNP opposition day last month. But in a letter, all three deputy speakers have unanimously ruled the speaker's role requires his conversations with members to remain confidential. All parties should be able to rely on that confidentiality. Allowing matters of privilege to be raised on the content of confidential conversations would undermine that principle. The letter, seen by The Times, addressed to the SNP's Chief Whip Owen Thompson, the Conservatives' Graham Brady and Plaid Cymru's Liz Savile-Roberts, adds that there is a high bar for raising complaints of breach of privilege. The deputy speakers, Rosie Winterton, Nigel Evans and Eleanor Lang, said their ruling was based on advice and precedence. It goes on, the complaint is founded on third-party reports of conversations held in confidence between Mr. Speaker and others, including the leader of the opposition. The Speaker regularly has conversations in confidence with members, including party leaders and whips. This is normal practice. There is no precedent for granting precedent to a complaint based purely on allegations of what might or might not have been said in a private meeting. There are no direct accounts of what was said from anyone who was actually in the room. We have decided not to give this matter precedence. Our decision is unanimous. Almost 100 MPs signed a motion of no confidence in Lindsay Hoyle after he broke with convention to select a Labour amendment as well as a government one to be heard on an SNP opposition day. This eventually resulted in an SNP motion calling for a ceasefire in Gaza and highlighting the collective punishment of Palestinians by Israel not being voted on. The Labour amendment, which did call for a ceasefire but did not mention collective punishment, was nodded through. Sir Keir Starmer categorically denied having threatened the Speaker after accusations were made that Lindsay Hoyle helped the Labour leader avoid another damaging revolt over the Middle East issue. He claimed that he simply urged Mr. Hoyle to have the broadest possible debate by putting a number of options in front of MPs. Labour MP Chris Bryant admitted he was ordered to filibuster to block progress on the SNP's motion and accepted the party had brought itself terribly into disrepute. The Speaker subsequently denied the SNP an emergency debate on Gaza, despite explicitly offering one after the chaos caused by his decision. SNP Westminster leader Stephen Flynn accused him of failing the people of Gaza. Meanwhile, Sir Keir Starmer has been accused of not being honest about cuts a Labour government would impose on public services after he repeatedly dodged the question on Sky News. The Labour leader appeared on Politics Hub with Sophie Ridge on Monday evening, where he was grilled on whether he was going to tax more, borrow more, or are you going to become the austerity Prime Minister? Sir Keir refused to answer Ms. Ridge when she asked, saying, "What we learned last week was a terrible indictment of 14 years in government." An article written by Steph Braun. The National, Politics, on Wednesday, the 13th of March. Stephen Flynn says they want to tax Scotland's industry to fund tax cuts in England. An exclusive article written by Lucy Jackson. Stephen Flynn has said Westminster wants to tax Scotland's industry to fund tax cuts in England, following the recent spring budget announcement. The SNP Westminster leader appeared on Talking Scotland, the National's podcast in collaboration with the Aberdeen Independence Movement, on Tuesday to discuss Scotland's energy sector and a just transition from fossil fuels towards renewable energy. The Conservatives are seeking to bankroll broken Brexit Britain on the back of Scotland's oil and gas, Mr. Flynn said in response to the extension of the windfall tax on oil and gas. He added, they want to tax Scotland's industry to fund tax cuts in England. In the spring budget, Chancellor Jeremy Hunt announced a 2 pence cut to national insurance contributions while extending and increasing the windfall tax on oil and gas. Mr. Hunt announced in the Commons that the cut in national insurance would be funded by additional taxes on vapes and tobacco, as well as the extension of the windfall tax on the oil and gas industry until 2029. Reports have suggested that 100,000 jobs could be wiped out if the windfall tax is hiked up any higher. Chancellor Jeremy Hunt kept it at the same level but extended the timeline by a year. But we reported that this would equate to the entire collapse of the industry. At the time, the Scottish Government described the budget as a betrayal of public services. Finance Secretary Shona Robison said, "Public services up and down the UK are in real need of investment, and they're being sacrificed to deliver unsustainable tax cuts." Mr. Flynn said the move showed that Westminster was certainly not working for people in the northeast of Scotland, who would be impacted most by the Chancellor's decision. Looking forward to the future of the energy sector, Mr. Flynn emphasised the need for a just transition, but one that worked for oil and gas workers in the northeast. "Those of us in Aberdeen, we live it and we understand it, because our communities, primarily the wealth that exists in them, has derived from the jobs available in the North Sea," he said. "There needs to be a transition, both economically and to deal with the challenges of climate change, but it has to be a just transition. We have a homegrown indigenous workforce that we have to protect, and the only people who will facilitate a net zero transition are the people currently in the jobs." Mr. Flynn added that Scotland is so well placed in the race to net zero, and that the energy sector is Scotland's future, but that it was being let down by Westminster. He pointed towards Scotland's offshore wind potential, adding that many workers currently in the fossil fuel industry were transient and would adapt to work on renewables as Scotland seeks to reach net zero. The renewables industry could generate millions for Scotland, as a new report revealed that Scotland's communities could benefit by £170 million per year if Holyrood acts now. This is because Scotland is much more energy rich than the rest of the UK due to its geographical location and the increased frequency of wet and windy weather. "We have more energy than we could possibly use if we are prepared to exploit it," energy expert Professor Gareth Harrison previously told The National. Earlier this year, we told that Scotland's green sector has delivered more electricity than Scotland used for the first time. Mr. Flynn, the SNP MP for Aberdeen South, said the 2 pence cut to national insurance would mean that the losers are the public, as budgets for infrastructure such as the NHS and schools would be tightened. "That is austerity on stilts, not just austerity 2.0, he said. When asked what the SNP would have done with the spring budget, Mr. Flynn said the party would have announced investment in both public infrastructure and in green technology. "If you want to create growth in the economy, if you want to create the jobs of tomorrow and replace the jobs of today, then you need to invest," he said. "We all want that independent Scotland where decisions aren't made in Westminster, but while we are there, we will defend the jobs we have now and speak loudly and proudly about jobs for the future." An exclusive article written by Lucy Jackson. The National News on Wednesday the 13th of March. Top charity rejects donation from sectarian Orange Walk flute band. An article written by Laura Pollock. A charity has turned down a donation from a flute band which hopes to lead an Orange Order walk through an Aberdeenshire town. Stonehaven RNLI refused the donation of £850 from Pride of the Rock after it was realised the band paid tribute to members of the Ulster Volunteer Force, the Press and Journal reported. The Ulster Volunteer Force is currently considered a terrorist organisation by the UK government. One MSP said that they were not surprised that the charity rejected the donation and called the move a clumsy attempt by the Orange Order to try to change the minds of the people of the North East. Aberdeenshire Council had determined that the parade in Stonehaven could have been a threat to safety and community life, and had concerns over undue strain on the police force, so blocked the event. However, the band could still lead the parade, as an appeal is due to take place at Aberdeen Sheriff Court on Friday. If successful, the parade could take place on March the 16th. A spokesperson for the RNLI said, "The RNLI looks at donations on a case-by-case basis in accordance with our donation acceptance policy. On this occasion, the decision has been made to refuse the donation." The charity's donation acceptance policy specifies that it should not welcome donations from an individual or company connected to activities which have led to the loss or serious harm of life. One tribute to the Ulster Volunteer Force's former commander in Scotland, William Campbell, described him as a leader of our community. Mr. Campbell was a convicted terrorist and was responsible for bombings which left 5 people injured in Glasgow in 1979. He was also connected to a bombing in Belfast in 1971, which killed 15 people. The band, which is based in Dumbarton, responded on social media, stating, "We have a lot to say about the Stonehaven situation. It can wait until after the judgment. Believe, we dare not boast. Believe, we do not fear." Kevin Stewart, the SNP MSP for Aberdeen Central, commented, "I'm not surprised that after viewing the sectarian content of this band's website, that the RNLI said, thanks but no thanks, to their offer. This was a clumsy attempt by the Orange Order to try to change the minds of the people of the North East so that they can march in our area. However, in their droves, the people of our corner of Scotland have made it quite clear that they do not want to see any sectarian marches." An article written by Laura Pollock. The National, politics, on Wednesday the 13th of March. Welsh people treated like second-class citizens, UK COVID inquiry told. An article written by Laura Pollock. Welsh people were treated like second-class citizens by the UK government during the pandemic, an inquiry has heard from the Welsh Labour Health Minister. Baroness Eluned Morgan, who took over the role from Vaughan Gething during the latter part of the pandemic, told the UK COVID-19 inquiry on Tuesday that people in Wales felt ignored by Westminster. She made the comment while addressing questions about the firebreak, a short 2-week lockdown in October 2020, and the UK government's refusal to help fund keeping it in place for longer. Baroness Morgan said, "We were really concerned about the financial ability, the firepower of the Welsh Government at the time to be able to sustain a lockdown for as long as was necessary. The scientists were suggesting we should be doing it for 3 weeks. I think we didn't have the economic power to maintain a 3-week firebreak." She said it was really disappointing that the UK Government was not forthcoming in terms of financial support. Then, 2 weeks later, when they wanted to go into a firebreak, they suddenly announced a different approach. "I think that was a very difficult time for us as a nation, because I think people felt that we were second-class citizens in the context of the UK government." Joanne Cecil, counsel to the inquiry, also showed the hearing several of Baroness Morgan's text and email messages from the pandemic. This included one to a colleague soon after she had taken up the Health Minister role, which said, "We are all F with 4*D. And another to the Health Minister of Northern Ireland, which said, "We are doomed." Baroness Morgan apologised for her fruity language and said it would not go down very well with her husband, who is a priest. She said the message came quite early on in her appointment and followed discussions about opening up the borders to travellers from France. On the same day, another meeting heard that the country should be put on the red restricted list. "I just found that a massive contradiction and very worrying," she said. Like other Welsh Government ministers, including Mr. Gething, who appeared on Monday, Baroness Morgan was asked why some of her messages were deleted. She said, "I don't know quite why or when, but clearly there were only a couple of examples where that happened." The inquiry also saw sections of her notebooks, which showed her questioning if Matt Hancock was hopeless and the Prime Minister chaos. The inquiry continues. An article written by Laura Pollock.
The National, Thursday the 14th of March, from the news section. Glasgow sex shop owners hit back at Tory MSP over hate crime reporting role. The co-founders of a Glasgow sex shop have hit back at a Tory MSP after she said their business was not an appropriate place for people to report hate crimes. Police Scotland has listed Luke and Jack's, a sex shop in Merchant City with a large LGBT plus clientele, as a third-party reporting centre for the Scottish Government's new hate crime laws, set to come into force next month. The laws create a new offence of stirring up hatred on the basis of protected characteristics such as age, disability, religion, sexual orientation or gender identity. Once in force, those who believe they may have been subject to a hate crime can choose to report the incident to a third-party centre. Across Scotland, they include places such as a mushroom farm and a smoked salmon facility. Yet on Wednesday, Tory MSP Annie Wells took issue with Luke and Jack's being included as a third-party reporting centre by Police Scotland. She said serious questions must be asked as to who thought a sex shop was an appropriate setting to report a hate crime. The SNP's act is flawed enough without asking people to relay their experiences in this sort of outlet in the heart of the city centre. Glaswegians will rightly be wondering what the thinking behind this decision. Police Scotland should drop this shop from the reporting centres as a matter of urgency. But co-owners Ian Diamond and his partner Drew Biggleston told The National that Wells had failed to do her due diligence on their shop and explained why they had signed up. "We actually became involved in this around 10 years ago," said Diamond. "At that time, their gay men's health organisations that were open during the day, which would have been the places where it was possible to get this kind of service. But funding cuts mean these places really don't exist anymore. There was no longer anywhere you could just walk in that was designed as a safe space for LGBT plus people during the day. Because we've been working so closely with the LGBT plus community in Glasgow for well over a decade, we felt we were a perfect fit when the police started talking about using businesses such as hairdressers as places to report hate crimes. They said that over the years they had undergone several training sessions on how to handle the reporting of hate crimes and were fully committed to more training. They added that the only interaction Wells appeared to have had with their shop was looking it up on Google Maps. She's never, as far as I know, visited the shop, said Biggleston. So she doesn't know anything about it. I think maybe there's a bit of due diligence required on her part to find out what she's actually criticising. We don't sell porn. It's simply products for sexual pleasure, lingerie and underwear. In many ways, we attempt to tailor our shop to be as approachable and non-offensive as possible. Diamond added that as long as long-standing LGBT-owned business already concerned with customers' privacy, they were actually well-placed to act as a third-party reporter. Our business relies on people trusting us to protect their privacy, said Diamond. If that doesn't make us the best people to deliver this service as well, then I don't really know who it is. For example, if someone was to come in and say, "My husband was shopping in here yesterday, what did he get?" we wouldn't entertain that. We understand that customers have a right to privacy when they enter our shop. If anything, we're far more aware of confidentiality than most other retail spaces. A Police Scotland spokesperson said, "Police Scotland has used hate crime third-party reporting centres for a number of years. In some cases, victims and witnesses of a hate crime may not feel comfortable approaching the police directly. Third-party reporting centres provide them with a safe space to make a report, and we constantly review these alongside the Scottish Government. Any business or organisation can volunteer to be a third-party reporting centre, and they reflect the diverse nature of our local communities. Staff are trained to ensure they can assist victims or witnesses. Hate crime and discrimination of any kind is deplorable and entirely unacceptable, and we will investigate every report." That's an article by Ross Hunter.
From the National, Thursday the 14th of March, from the sports section. McCoy's pinpoints Rangers' defensive sin in terrible Benfica goal. Article written by David Irvin and read by me, Ian. Ali McCoy's reckons Benfica's goal at Ibrox was terrible from a Rangers point of view. The Ibrox icon was stunned as Rafa Silva smashed home the winner to knock Rangers out of the Europa League just seconds after Rangers had a corner. McCoy slaughtered the tactic at Ibrox as he claimed his former side failed to heed warnings in the first half of a serious threat from counter-attacks. And in a damning verdict, McCoy stated conceding goals like the one Benfica scored was inexcusable at any level of football. On TNT Sports, McCoy explained, "That cannot happen from your own corner. I don't care who you are or what level you are, I'm afraid to say that cannot happen at any level of football. That is your corner and two passes and Rafa Silva, who, in my opinion, I thought was the best player on the pitch, I thought he was absolutely terrific, all of a sudden, he is through with the goalkeeper to beat. You have got to call it as you see it. I think it is a terrible goal to lose defensively. I think this Rangers team did themselves proud over the two legs, but in that particular situation, that little bit of analysis, they got one or two warnings in the first half. That wasn't a one-off, I reckon. It was two or three times in the first half where Rangers have got a corner in the wide area and I'm looking and they've got the defender 50 to 60 yards from their own goal. Benfica sneaked through in the Europa League with a 1-0 victory at Ibrox, enough to secure a 3-2 aggregate win over Rangers. Rafa Silva netted the winner as he raced clear, just beating the offside trap by being inside his own half and fired into the bottom corner from Angel Di Maria's headed pass. And that article was written by David Irvin. From the National, Thursday the 14th of March, from the sports section, Scotland need best rugby of season against Ireland, says Townsend. Article by Anthony Brown. Greg Townsend admits Scotland will have to do something special in Dublin as he challenged them to score at least 20 points against Ireland and give themselves a fighting chance of a first triple crown since 1990. The Scots are heading to the Irish capital looking to save face after a shock defeat in Italy last weekend, all but ended their hopes of winning the championship and left them staring at the possibility of finishing fifth if results go against them on Saturday. Townsend is braced for a formidable test against a side the Scots have lost to in each of their last nine meetings, including a chastening 36-14 at the World Cup just 5 months ago. "We know how tough it's going to be," he said. "They're one of the top two teams in the world, and at home they've been virtually unbeatable the last few years, so it's going to require something special from our players. We've got to accept that they'll score points on Saturday. I think before, losing 23-22 to England, they were averaging 30 points a game, so it will be a test for our defence, and we have to score points. We have to get 20 or more, which will be tough, but we believe we can do that against any team." Townsend conceded that there's a sense of regret that Scotland, who have 2 wins out of 4 so far, are not heading to Ireland with a genuine chance of winning the title. "The frustration is that we're not going to Dublin on the back of 4 wins, he said. "We feel we had a win taken away from us against France, and obviously Italy deserved their win, but we feel we could have been better that day. But we have this game ahead of us to show us our best performance of the season. We're still playing for something, not just a place at in the table, it's for a trophy, the Triple Crown, and also we're playing one of the best teams in the world, so that's got to inspire us to deliver our best rugby. It's weird to think we're the only team that can win the Triple Crown, but the focus is on the performance. We know we have to play our best rugby this week. We're away to Ireland, and it's the ultimate challenge in the game right now. The huge motivator for us is to try and deliver our best rugby of the season." Despite last weekend's disappointment, Townsend has opted to make just 2 changes, with Glasgow centre Stafford McDowell replacing Cam Redpath, and first-choice scrum half Ben White returning at expense of George Horn. The head coach is adamant there is no need for a wholesale overhaul of the team. "If you suddenly change what you're doing because of one defeat or one performance, that has some negative elements, and you're forgetting what went on beforehand, he said. Before that 20-minute period in the second half in Italy, when we lost our focus, we played a lot of good rugby, and we played a lot of good rugby leading up to the Italy game. We know we have to deliver our best performance of the season on Saturday to come away with a positive result, and we believe the players we've selected. Townsend was heavily criticised after the Italy defeat, but he dismissed any notion that he had felt the weight of the world on his shoulders since returning from Rome. "No, I feel massive responsibility and privilege being in this job," he said on Thursday. "It's a huge purpose in my life. I've got a fantastic coaching staff and a great group of players around me, and I love being in this role. It's disappointing when you don't get your best performance, but there's another game to work towards this weekend." And that article was written by Anthony Brown.
That concludes this week's edition of the National Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Hume Review and tell your friends about our service.